This episode of Literary Treks is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading in case I got bored.
Welcome to Literary Treks episode number 285. This is your official Star Trek books and comics podcast here on the Trek FM network. And I am Bruce Gibson. Thank you so much for joining us. And we also, of course, have Dan Gunther here. Dan, how's it going?
Hey, not too bad. As always, excited to talk about Star Trek novels and this one in particular that we'll be doing in the future with a special guest.
Yes, this is the 40th anniversary of Star Trek The Motion Picture, and we're actually going to read the novelization, which I think is a first. We've never done a novelization on the show, if I recall.
I don't think that we have, no. Now I'm wondering, has the show done the Star Trek Into Darkness novelization? Because that would have come out during its run.
I don't recall it. If it, I don't think it, I don't know. I was going to go back and look, but I don't think so. I don't know. Yeah. But anyway, it's been a long time.
And we should say, you know, one of the main reasons we're doing this novelization in particular, like you said, it's the 40th anniversary, but Pocket Books has also reprinted and re-released the novelization in a shiny new glossy black covered trade paperback, which I was really happy to add to my collection, even though I have the I have a 1979 printing of the novelization. But, you know, this new edition, which sadly there's nothing really new in it. It's just a reprint of the original novelization, but it's still a really cool thing to have.
But it's in that bigger trade paperback size that they've been doing new novels in. So it's a bigger version than the paperbacks that originally came out. It does say on the top that's a 40th anniversary edition or printing or whatever. So that's that's the only difference on it. And speaking of the motion picture, we are getting a new book related to the motion picture. And it's called Star Trek The Motion Picture Inside the Art and Visual Effects. And it was just recently announced. I saw it from Trek Corps on October 2nd, and they said that it's a new book exploring the creative efforts behind the first Star Trek film, and it's coming out May 2020. And the authors are Jeff Bond and Gene Kozicki. So I'm definitely going to buy this. I think it's probably going to be like a coffee table book.
Yeah, this one is one I'm really excited to add to my collection as well. Say what you will about Star Trek The Motion Picture. I love it, but I know it has its detractors out there. But one thing you can't fault it for is the art and the visual effects. So, you know, this is something that I think is going to be a really great companion piece to that film. And I'm, like you, definitely going to add it to my collection.
Yes. And then, obviously, as we mentioned, we're going to be talking about the novelization in the feature. And yes, that special guest is Larry Nemechek, Dr. Trek. There you go.
We can't exactly have the author on, but definitely the next best thing.
Absolutely, yes. Well, let's look at the listener feedback for episode number 283 of Literary Treks, where we discussed the novel Vendetta. This is a TNG novel and one of my favorites, if not my favorite, of the TNG novels. And Christopher Backus says, I remember liking that book. I haven't read it in decades. And I replied to him and I said, it had been a long time since I read it too.
Yeah. I read it much more recently, but it was still a lot of fun to get back to it after a few years for sure. Well, Oz Trekkie says, this is a Peter David Borg book done right. I didn't reread this one before listening to the podcast and haven't read it in ages, but I still remember every chapter, every plot point, as I have reread this one so many times in the past. The humor and interweaving of stories shown on screen blended into this great story make this one of my all-time favorite TNG novels. This is a story where Peter David's humor fits to a T. Everyone is tilting at windmills in this novel, and apart from defeating the Borg, important to do, everyone fails in their personal quest. Picard and Guinan can't save Delcara, Delcara doesn't reach the Borg, and Geordi can't save Rhiannon. It's an unusual Trek novel where the main characters aren't ultimately successful in their endeavors. I remember this made the novel stand out for me when I first read it. There are so many good memories that I have about this novel. I rate this 5 out of 5 beams of pure anti-proton energy coming at you.
Awesome. And then Grant Davis says, one of the first Trek books I read, also one of my favorites. Looking forward to listening. Yeah, Grant, it's one of my favorites, obviously, too.
Definitely, me too. Justin Ozer comments, Vendetta is a novel that I really enjoyed, and I think my feelings are mirrored by what Dan had to say. I had a few minor issues, but really enjoyed it overall. Thank you for always having a great discussion. Well, thank you, Justin, for always listening, and for mirroring my thoughts. That shows you to be a person of great taste and sophistication.
Oh, whatever. And Nicholas Isles says, great read. Exclamation point.
And we have a comment from D. Baish, or D. Baish. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name there. They say, this is one of the few novels I've reread, devoured it within an afternoon after buying it on release day. Years later, it entered the novel rotation when I commuted into the city for work. That original copy is long gone now, but I'll be taking yet another look via ebook, thanks to this podcast.
And Kimberly Lawler says, the giant novels. Wow, that takes me back. Bruce Gibson. I guess the numbered novels were slimmer, but I'm glad we get longer novels as a matter of course now. I'm going to dissent from the consensus and say that I didn't love this novel. I can live with alternate and superseded timelines like the Shatnerverse or different versions of the Stargazer crew in Reunion versus the autobiography of Picard. But this one never sat right with me. The characterization felt a little off, and the disturbing elements were even more disturbing than usual. I, Borg, as an episode, is so much better in the way that Geordi and Beverly work together to save Hugh instead of being somewhat at odds, and the way Picard and Guinan reacted to him, which was powerful. This novel was memorable for sure, but I never wanted to reread it the way I did with the other Peter David ones. Dan Gunther, Q-Squared, is also my all-time favorite TNG novel.
And another commenter with great taste and sophistication. Thank you, Kimberly.
Oh, whatever.
Jen Foley says, I usually tune out the beginning of the podcast when you talk about comics since I don't read them. However, I heard Bright Eyes and suddenly the words turn around popped into my head. This was definitely a better novel than Before Dishonor. It did have some issues, as you mentioned. Captain Korsmo ordering his crew to fire on the Enterprise stands out as one part that didn't make much sense to me. Geordi's obsession with the Borg drone was a little weird, too. Overall, however, it was a good story. I always love stories where Guinan gets a role, and the backstory with her and Delcara was interesting. Delcara was an interesting character in her own right, as were the voices, if they can be considered a character. I also applaud Peter David for creating a female Borg. Since the Borg assimilated entire societies, it would have made no sense if there weren't any females.
And Patrick Harlan says, this is one I've always enjoyed. I remember buying it at the now closed downtown Minneapolis Barnes & Noble. And then I walked a few blocks down to the Nicollet Mall to the multi-level McDonald's, got a few quarter pounders with cheese, and settled in at one of the upper level tables to read it. Oh my gosh, Patrick, that's like my dream, because I you know, people like all the time say to me like, ugh, McDonald's, but yeah, I love quarter pounders with cheese, and reading Star Trek at a Barnes & Noble or in the upper level of McDonald's would be great for me too.
That sounds terrific, definitely. Well, Christopher Baca says, found my original signed novel and posted a photo of his copy of Vendetta signed Best Peter David. So that's really cool. That's something I wish I had in my collection. So hang on to that. That's a really nice piece of memorabilia.
Yes. And I love that as an idea, because the next time I see Peter David at Dragon Con, I'm going to bring my Vendetta novel for him to sign. I never thought to do that.
Yeah, and I'll bring my little Kobo e-reader and bring it up and then have him sign the screen. Wait, that's probably not a good idea.
No, probably. But you know what is a good idea? Going into the feature.
I agree completely. I'll meet you there.
I'm very excited to talk about the novelization to Star Trek The Motion Picture. And of course, doing it with Dan, but also with Larry Nemechek, Dr. Trek. Because, you know, Larry, you always have some really interesting little nuggets of information. You always find new stuff, too, in the Trek files. So I don't know if you're going to have anything new for this, but I'm really excited to talk to you about this.
No.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, no, I will just discuss this with Dan.
Larry will just be here, just kind of hanging out while we talk, I guess.
That sounds good. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I just thought I'd go Packlet on you for a second there. Okay. No, I'll. It's really amazing to me to see the motion picture, like, kind of come out. It's like somebody went off and dug it out of the bottom of the museum and pulled it out. Went, oh, you know, blow off the dust and right. Went, okay, everybody. I know you all love to make fun of this 90% of the time, but it is the 40th anniversary, so show some respect and let's all get and look at it really again. And oh, you know, it's fun to watch people pull it out and actually treat it with some respect. So.
Yeah, and I'm right there with you, because I've mentioned on the show before, I actually love the motion picture, and it's one of those things that, like, really brought me into Star Trek. My mom rented the VHS copy and brought it home, and I think, like, I saw the Klingon ships going past the screen, past the camera, and I was like, oh, what is this? And I was just in love. The motion picture, oh, it's right up there for me.
Well, I'll tell you in a minute, but the Klingon ships is one of, like, my most vivid memories of seeing it in the theater the first time, but...
Oh, anyway. I still haven't seen it in the theater. I wish they'd...
Oh,
if
wow.
only someone would show it in here. Theaters on a mass scale for the anniversary. If only.
Yeah, if only they did that where I live here in Canada.
That's just That'd a great. That's just a phantom dream of mine, I guess. So.
Because you really do need to see it on a big screen. I have my own little, like, movie theater room with a projector, and I watched it the other week, and I just realized watching it on the big screen how much better it plays. I mean, I love the motion picture too, but when you see it on the big screen, because of the whole, you know, the clouds and the, you know, it's this big environment they're going into. And of course it's slow, but it's like on the big screen, it really feels like you're traveling through it with them. It really works.
The whole cinematic-y thing.
The whole cinematic-y yeah. thing. And I did see it originally in the theaters when it came out in 79. I went with my family. I wasn't a big Star Trek fan. I mean, I knew Star Trek and all that, but I wasn't like a huge fan. But I remember seeing it. I was excited about seeing it. And I left a little bit confused. And I knew my dad used to watch the series on TV. And I said, turned to him, I said, I'm a little confused. I said, so the bad guy was a cloud? And he's like, Yeah, I'm confused too. And of course, now I watch them like, why was I confused? This totally makes sense.
Well, now after 47,000, you know, Star Trek movies and 47,000 different aliens, it's cool to go, the villain was a cloud, you know. And it's like, it's different because it's not the 57th reincarnation of a Khan type villain. I mean, you know, it's like right. racing for that bar. Anyway, we should get into that.
But had I watched the animated series all the way through at that time, which I probably saw a couple episodes, I probably would have accepted the cloud more, because in my rewatch of the animated series, I realized how many clouds that they're dealing with in the animated series.
Clouds are cheaper than planets. It's like...
easier to animate.
It's like Voyager should be called the one in the caves. Because they, you know, use caves yeah. over and over and over again.
That's true. So, Larry, I know you saw it in the theater when it originally came yeah. out. But now you were telling us on the other side of the page. You like how we say that?
The other side of the page? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. You think you may have read this novelization before you saw the movie. May have.
Well, I was really trying to remember. I remember reading The Wrath of Khan's novelization before seeing it. Because I actually... I don't think I've ever said this out loud. I actually teared up when Kirk said his was the most human. And I was like, I teared up, and then I was in shock. It's like, my God, I'm tearing up over reading the damn book before I even see the movie? That's ridiculous. Wow. But, oh, sorry, spoiler alert, everybody.
Ooh.
But I want to say that I did, because I, you know, we can get into this, but the whole thing about Lori Siani. Okay, the other thing is I'm reading up on notes wherever I can, and Siani was a typo, and it should have been Siana. And it was I, because my whole, you know, my memory train is it's Lori Siani at Vice Admiral Lori Siani, his wife and his marriage contract, which is one of the amazing things in the novel that's not on anywhere on screen that fleshes it out. But I want to say that as the transporter accident scene unfurls, I was sitting in the theater going, wow, they don't say that that's Lori Siani at all.
Hmm.
So anyway, I know the books that's were on sale. And it's a total, she's just an extra, you know, Sonak and some woman over there. You know, you don't know that she's a, who she is or that she's an admiral or much less this whole background that he makes up for the novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember watching rewatching the movie after reading this novelization again. And I wanted to see if they called her out because I didn't think they did. But yeah, he makes no comments. Just, you know, contact the families.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the thing that's different about the motion picture, and I don't say this as an excuse, because there is a divided fandom on this, and part of it is, it's not all just about if you were alive then, but people who were alive and conscious of it and saw it in context, and had a few years before it even, this is what, like, that. There's a duty to propagate this, because yes, any motion picture, like any series, should stand alone, right? You shouldn't have to have read the promotional stuff. You shouldn't have to, my God, you shouldn't have had to read the novelization if there's one. You shouldn't have had to have, you know, kept up with all the interviews ahead of time and seen the previews and you should be able to go in and sit down and watch any movie and then it should be able to be judged on its merits right then. And then maybe the passage of time alters that. And this is the only one of the Star Trek movies that I will say, yes, of course, and it has its flaws, and some things were, you know, pacing and cutting and all that, and original goals and dreams to visualize it were handled with the director's cut that they oversaw, and hopefully they'll get to 4K now or whatever it now, the way Darren Dockerman's been teasing. But the motion picture, beyond any other Trek movie, is the one that you need to realize what it was besides just what you sit down and watch on a screen. Because the motion picture, when some people trot out the idea that until the first JJ movie, this made the most money of any Star Trek movie, more than Wrath of Khan, more than Voyage Home, right. You know, yada yada, more than First Contact, it made the most money. Why? With all its flaws? Because there was 10 years of pent-up demand for it, because the whole point of fandom in the beginning was to get Star Trek back. Mm-hmm. It wasn't to figure out what to do next. It wasn't to figure out, go do this, do that. It wasn't to, you know, the whole point of fandom was, you took our show away from us, damn it, and we want it back. And until we get it back, we'll make up our own stories, and we'll do our own, you know, we'll make our own costumes and our props, and we'll do our own tech manuals, and we'll do our own thing. So, yeah, on you. You know, and somewhere somebody would say, if you guys want to make some money, just do it again. And then you went through all the stuff of how to do that, you know, the 70s. And it was like you'd be teased and, you know, and we're getting into that on the Trek Files. And people, are, you know, there are songs sung about this throughout the Empire about what the 70s were like. And you'd be teased and Gene's trying to do other things and not be held back to his old product. But at the same time, he had this winner chicken dinner thing here that he couldn't get rid of. And he's walking the line between trying to do other projects and sell things and keep this alive, which had never been done before. No dead show had ever been brought back years later, much less with the same people. But they're all 10 years older. Who's going to go watch that? I mean, you know, that's the suit bean counter mentality. And the fact that Star Trek broke this paradigm and did all that, and that it's this synergy thing of they had wanted to do it for years and they were bungling around trying to find the right way. And some of it was Gene's fault and some of it was people not getting it, and Paramount was turning over in leadership, and then George Lucas gets his funding for his film because of Star Wars breaking out, and then Star Trek gets made because of Star, you know, that little synergy is so karmically ironic now that people try to, you know, make the clickbait battle between the fandoms, where they actually helped each other, And then you finally, and then a TV series, and then it's not a TV series on a new network. It's going to go back to the theater, bigger. We're going to blow so much money on this, you won't believe. The human spending adventure is just beginning, you know? And then here it is. So you had all it. So the motion picture, to me, unlike any other Trek movie, even like with JJ's, with Star Trek 09, where it came back out of whatever, nothing can compare with the experience of all of us going to the movie when it was first out.
And back then, too, this also helped get the rescue of Gilligan's Island on TV, in my opinion, to reunite a cast.
Oh, yes. Anyway. That, too.
That, too. But they had a cloud on there, too.
With the motion picture, though, we can't forget they completely changed the style of everything. They changed all the uniforms, and the Klingons don't even look the same. Like, up in arms.
No, I'm sorry.
Are you talking about Discovery?
I'm sorry. We're talking about the motion picture and the novelization tonight.
Yeah, that, too. You know, because now this is interesting because Alan Dean Foster wrote the story and screenplay, right, to the motion picture, but Gene Roddenberry wrote the novelization. Mm-hmm. Well, how did that all work out?
The script for the motion picture was the pilot for Phase 2, or it wasn't called Phase 2. It was every time there was a read. This is what's fun about going back to the Trek files and Gene's papers is every time, you know, now we say the God thing, we say Planet of the Titans, we say Phase 2 for the TV show. But every time there was an iteration, even the first time they thought about doing an animation 4 years before it filmation, which I don't know if Aaron and Rich get into that in their book. I haven't got to swallow it up yet. But every time there was going to be anything that was going to be the new Star Trek form, whatever it was, you look at the script page and Gene just called it Star Trek 2, which has led to a lot of confusion. People see Star Trek 2 and they think Wrath of Khan. It's like, well, this is a Wrath of Khan. It's like, no, everything that was going to be the next thing after 1969, he started off calling it Star Trek 2. Then later on, we've given it these post names of, you know, the God thing, and then Planet of the Titans, and then Phase 2, and probably even in the early days of the motion picture before they came out and did that, when they had the big press conference and had the painted, you know, it looks like the 20s letters, the Roaring 20s letters, a big press conference, and it was a big splash, and they had the whole cast there, and they did the big Paramount, we're going to make this a mega movie, big budget smash epic feature treatment to get that across. Yeah, everything got called to it. But Phase 2, the series, was going to launch the Paramount Network. It was going to do Fox only, you know, 10 years before Fox. And it was going to be Voyager only 20 years before Voyager and UPN. But when Diller first wanted to have the original fourth network and have it be Paramount, and stop me if you heard this before, it was going to be, right, Phase 2 was going to be the flagship of the new network, because if you've got, even then, they were like, if we're going to launch a new thing, our strongest thing is Star Trek to, you know, put out there. And they had, like, 13 scripts commissioned, and Nimoy wouldn't be back, just real quick here. Nimoy would not come back and do it. He thought about maybe doing an appearance in the pilot, and then Zahn was going to be the full Vulcan science officer, so it would be a different dynamic. And the poor guy that was cast to be Zahn was David Gautreaux, and he winds up being Commander Branch in the motion picture as a caveat. But Ilia and Decker are all going to be characters in the series. And then when they yank that because they realize it's not going to make money and they want to outdo Star Wars and Close Encounters and all of that and make this a big budget, they just took the pilot episode, the 2-hour pilot called In Thy Image, and just rewrote it. So that's why, yeah, that's why his name is... That's why Alan Dean Foster's
Who wrote the pilot episode?
Well, he did. And then, you know, Gene rewrote. And John Povel, who was a story editor, was in there too. But the original script, the 2-hour pilot for Phase 2, the series, was called In Thy Image. And to hurry things up, because they'd been through this development hell with two different scripts in the 70s, they went, we don't want to around with this thing anymore. We're going to do it big. Just take the damn 2-hour pilot and blow that up. That looks good. And then they did. So Alan Dean Foster, when he wrote that pilot, that was like 77. That was like an eternity and a half ago by the time they actually got down to doing the movie and then thinking of like spin-off things like, you know, the novel.
Yeah, because the novel says on the cover, a novel by Star Trek's creator Gene Roddenberry based on the screenplay by Harold Livingston and the story by Alan Dean Foster. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's quite interesting. And Gene, I don't think, had ever written a novel. Oh, you have the photo story.
And the
too.
Photo story, since the photo books had been, the photo novels for the episodes had been good, somebody thought, oh, we should do a photo novel for the motion picture, which is interesting too. But it's the same, you know, the 13 or so photo novels for episodes that they'd sold off in the 70s. In the era before you had, you know, VHS tapes, much less DVDs. Mm-hmm. And it was a great way to have a chunk of this thing in hand that you could look at. And same credits. Screenplay by Harold Livingston, story by Alan Dean Foster.
I'm glad we've kind of brought up Alan Dean Foster, because this has kind of been a myth surrounding this novelization as well, that Alan Dean Foster ghost wrote it and they put Roddenberry's name on it. But that is unequivocally not the case. Like, and I think part of that comes from that story credit for the motion picture script. But Gene Roddenberry undoubtedly wrote this.
There's too many interesting, weird little sex things all through here exactly. for it not to have been Gene Roddenberry. Yeah.
I'm glad you said that, because...
Yeah. No, it's like, definitely. Who else? But unless he's sitting over here dictating it, like verbatim or something, but...
Larry, I think you read the wrong version, because none of that was in mine.
You were how old when you saw the movie in the theater? You might want to go back and read it again. That's all I'm saying.
And I mean, there's also just, you know, reading anything by Alan Dean Foster and comparing it to this, it just doesn't compute. Like, it does. Yeah. No, this is definitely. So let's officially put that myth to bed here. And
oh,
now.
I didn't know that was a raging myth. But yes, I mean, yeah, go read the log books from the animated series novelizations. Mm-hmm. And yes.
Yeah. Anytime this novelization comes out in the comments, someone says that somewhere. And no, that's not the case.
Yeah, because Alan Dean Foster was the ghostwriter for the Star Wars novelization.
Right, that's the other side.
It was published with George Lucas's name, so I think that gets all confused, which I have my original novelization. Had Alan Dean Foster signed the Star Wars one. And it can get all confusing.
This is why I keep, 10 years ago, I thought, oh, everything is old. I'm just going to go live in a cave because we have nothing new to talk. Well, now we actually have new Star Trek, but... For a long time, it was. Then I'd see things like this come up and go, guys, we have the interwebs now. Stuff is actually preserved. You don't have to go get sacred tablets and read it. Why are you being so stupid? But like, you can go read this. Stop saying stuff you don't know about. It's out there. It's not the sacred chalice of Reek's knowledge. I mean, you can go get it anywhere. We have, you know. So for people to be saying that, it's like, but, you know, people love to propagate.
Yeah. And that's the problem, too, is with all this access to information, we have all the access to the people saying the wrong information and having that repeated as well. So, it's an interesting world we've decided to create.
You only hear the right information on this show. Only the right information. But it's interesting that Gene Roddenberry wrote this novel, and it wasn't just the script, that he did put his own elements in, because now you're getting into the head of Gene Roddenberry of 1979. Now, some of these ideas he may not have had originally with the series. I don't know. Maybe not. But now, we get like the Admiral Kirk's preference in here where, Kirk's surname, that this is not a tradition. This is an old tradition of passing on the last name from father to the children. That's a futuristic idea of, sometimes you take the identity of a family name, sometimes you don't.
Mm-hmm. Well, the whole thing about the book continues. Again, when you look at the movie in context, so much of the movie... We were laughing about how much, this whole thing about everything changed in Discovery. I'm sorry, kids. Do you remember the motion picture? Uniforms, costumes, Klingons, ships, the look, the tech. Everything was different. But in 78 and 79, it was all about, okay, guys, how for 10 years you wanted a big return for Star Trek? We're not just going to bring it back to TV. We're going to make it on a movie. So we get to spend all kinds of movie money, and it's going to look good on a big... I mean, everything was about that. Wait, I'm sorry. What happened to our pretty red and blue and gold uniforms? Oh, they'll look too pajama-like on a big screen. We got to have these, like, boring Robert Wise 2001 colors, These Space 1999 drabble of things. And they talk about how the budget went up, and it was mainly because of the insane visual effects, 24/7 for 9 months effort, and then the reshoots and redoing all that stuff. Plus, everything they'd spent on all those monies, all those movies through the 70s, they threw that cost on the bottom line of the motion picture, which makes it even more amazing that it took in so much money and then didn't go in the hole, and that they decided to, they knew it was a no-brainer to do another movie, do a sequel, quote unquote. They just, like, Bluthorn told Harb Bennett, you know, can you make a movie for less than $150 million? And Harb Bennett said, sir, I can make three movies for $150 million. Right. You know.
Yeah, they spent less than that on the rescue of Gilligan's Island too.
We're really marching down the aisle with that Gilligan's Island thing. Come back.
It was around the same time.
But my point here is that, and then Gene got, you know, blamed and fired and demoted for, you know, it cost so much money, and he was kind of a mess as a producer a little bit, but a lot of stuff he gets blamed for unfairly. You know, like, who knew that Robert April was going to, you know, that was the studio wanted that, and that was on the visual effects, and that was a blow up. But the point is that so much of what you see on screen is them having a wish list and no one said no.
Did you
no.
mean Robert Wise?
What did I say?
Robert April.
No, Robert Abel.
Mm. Oh, Abel.
Robert Abel and Associates, the original visual. Like, okay. They did cool Levi's and 7-Up commercials, and everybody thought they could do visual effects to rival Star Wars. But but it's like the movie, what you see on screen is like a wish list of stuff. And it's like, not just, we didn't have the money to do this, so now we're going to do it big. And it was also like, and now we're going to have sex on screen. And, you know, we're going to show how immaturely we are about sex, much less everything else. And then what didn't get on screen is in the book. Yeah, it's like, this is the movie script times five. So all this...
This is Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, Star Trek.
No, yes. Nobody. That's this whole thing about who ghost wrote it for Gene. It's like, no. This is like, here's what I couldn't get in the movie. I'll put it in the novel. And, you know.
Such as what? What did he put in there?
Well, the whole... Well, number one, talk about 10 years of fandom. The whole Tahila answer to slash fiction. I can't talk. That's a huge... It's a tiny... Like I said, the... If you didn't have the story of the novel, but you just had the end notes, there's enough quasi-canon in just the end notes of this thing to set you, you know, equal to us two seasons of a normal TV series, of a Trek TV series.
I like that there's all those notes in there.
But the Tahila thing, he specifically calls out the whole Kirk Spock, you know, the KS slash.
Yeah, because Tahila in Vulcan means, it means friend, but also means brother and lover. And apparently there were rumors, according to these notes, that Kirk and Spock may have been lovers. And that's getting to the whole Kirk Spock slash fiction, like a wink.
It's really the best politician in Gene, because he's addressing it. He's not giving it credence, but he leaves the door open. So it's like, so you can take away whatever you want to take away. And it's a footnote. So who's really reading that? Wink, wink.
So, you know, exactly. And I always tease about, is that canon? But in this case, this is written by Gene Roddenberry. Is this canon? Maybe there were rumors that Spock and Kirk were lovers, and that's canon.
Well, we should look at some specific topics. We could sit here and like go in circles all night, but there's a whole.
Another thing that's brought up early on is kind of this world building that Gene Roddenberry does is this idea of the new human society, which I thought was really fascinating. And like the context of this, like putting myself in the shoes of Gene Roddenberry, as frightening a thought as that may be, there was nothing else of Star Trek except those original three seasons and the animated series. But, you know, this was it. So we hadn't really gotten a look at Earth at all as far as the 23rd century goes. And it wasn't even the 23rd century. It was just some unspecified time in the future. And this kind of whole idea of the new human civilization and the fact that primitives are what make up Starfleet. The people we're seeing on screen are throwbacks to the olden days, and humans are evolved beyond that. I thought that was really fascinating, and just like trying to kind of reconcile that with what we see later, which you really can't do. But at the time, that's all there was the original series. So it's an interesting take.
Well, I think all of that is, A, it's the 70s, for one thing. Okay.
It's the dawning of the age of Aquarius.
yeah. Well, no, I mean, just think, you know, all the, it was like the post-hippie, new agey, you know, everything. But
crystal blue persuasion kind of.
You're starting to go there.
And, yeah.
Yeah, but you were starting to have cults, and you were starting to have, you know, TM. I mean, all this, the cycle babble self-involvement, you know, schools, and I don't want to say cults, but movements. That's what he called this. He called it a new humans movement. But part of these endnotes and things, starting with Tahila and other things, I think were, there were 10 years of people going off and doing zine editions, and there were fan theories, you know, all kinds of things over the years, and things that he, like you said, things he wanted to do. I mean, the animated series got into some of the things he wanted to do, like the holodeck or the rec deck or whatever, which, yeah, you go back and read the making of Star Trek. He says there are they talked about him as a relief for homesickness. You know, you can go visit your home planet in the holodeck. They didn't think about it so much for training, much less, you know, sex or whatever you wanted to do. I'm going to recreate my film noir film detective hero here, and not, you know, fiction. You know, we're going to refight Sherlock Holmes. I'm going to go to Ireland. Whatever it is you think you need to do with a holodeck. The Vulcan love goddess of, you know, whatever. or, you know, the baseball Buck Pokai's team. But he wanted that originally. He just didn't have the mind to do it or portray it. But he said it out loud, and it's in all the books from the – it's in the Bible from the 60s, so that when Franz Josef Schnabel did the blueprints on his own, but with kind of in league with – there's holographic view cubicles and rooms all over the place in the old original – you know, the 1701 blueprints from 73 and 74. And then it winds up in the animated, and we don't, it's not really part of the movie series until we get to Next Generation. But that's an example of all the things that he had floating in his head that was just a matter of how can we get them out there. So, yeah, a lot of what you see coming up, and not even that, but in any of the incidental material. What's weird to me, there are two things, and since we got on this topic, I kept assuming they were in the novel. But what's funny is they've come back up again in recent years, or at least one of them has. One of them is this whole thing, and it's said here. It's this part is in the novel where Kirk says he's almost in his foreword, and he says he's writing in first person and says he's almost embarrassed because Starfleet made such a PR bonanza out of him and his crew, and they've blown us up to larger than life, which is funny. You know, it's like the Captain Scully here or something or whatever. Sully, I mean. But yeah, Scully was a different thing. That is in there. What I've been trying to find, I know, I swear to God, in 1978 and 79, I read it somewhere where they said, and to honor his crew and the Enterprise, they decided to, you know, get rid of ship-to-ship patches and insignias and make the Enterprise insignia the insignia of all Starfleet. Mm-hmm. Which we, you know, no one dreamed that up. It was there. And then we've come into this thing, we've kind of retconned that back now to, you know, despite what you saw on the Constellation and on the retcon Defiant from Enterprise and the Exeter. Despite what you saw there, and you know, like the Bob Justman, this is like John Cooley's, you know, campaign here, the Bob Justman memo where he's yelling about the Omega Glory patch, but they had already done it on the Constellation. Well, that meant something. That whole little debate. Really, no one ever thought about it because they didn't have the money to show other ships. But I swear to God, that was put down somewhere in some of the. It's obviously not on a screen. I have gone back to the novel. I cannot find it. It had to be in some promotional. But a lot of we didn't have this like mass hallucination. We all envisioned that from the time that became the thing and was out there, and it came from Paramount, where there was an interview with Robert Fletcher or something, but. But I know it was in something that came from somewhere. But the bit about we are the first ship to come back relatively intact from our 5-year mission with crew and ship intact, that is Roddenberry did do that.
Yeah.
But yeah, all the way through here are little bits that he's putting in basically to either, like Tahila, he's either answering, and if you have no idea all this is going on, it's fine. It goes right past you. But Gene, all through the novel, at least, is like taking the moment because it's cheap. Words are cheap on a piece of paper, ink. He's like addressing either a controversy or he's seen like different divergent theories, and he's gonna put down the law as to what he thinks that, you know, the theory should be. So Tahila is the big one, but there's some little things that he, you know, he talks about. So
I also feel like he's doing a retcon to when he says like the new humans and the missions were fictionalized, larger than life about Kirk and all. It's taking that in-universe perspective and calling out the episodes as if, you know, well, these were little you know, exaggerated, and oh, the new humans, you know, the humans that you saw on the Enterprise are more primitive people, and now we have these humans that on New Earth that are more intelligent. But I wonder if the brain of Gene Roddenberry, his opinions of the series changed from the late 60s to the late 70s to the point where those characters are more primitive. They're more like the 20th century. And because when we get to the Next Generation, he makes everybody more perfect. When we get to the Next Generation, I feel like this is his way of calling out that, well, those characters aren't really how I would portray them now. So I'll just say that they're more primitive on starships, and, you know, and the missions were a little exaggerated.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there are a couple of things. And like, you know, in the meantime, like David Gerald had written his books where he had some critiques. A lot of things they answered in The Next Generation. Like, it's silly to have a captain. No naval vessel captain would jump off his ship, be the first one ashore. You know, you send other people. The captain's too valuable to do that.
Yes,
you know, you don't. Right. No one uses a transporter that breaks down every other episode. So what are you doing with that? So, okay, fine. We'll have Next Generation. Instead. Exactly. We've got perfect transporters and our holodeck breaks down. A lot of those things, you know, over as the years went by and you're out of the week to week, get the damn show done, and it's something that is of value enough that it hangs around and people don't just enjoy it, but on the, you know, the 30th or 40th or 47th viewing, people are starting to look at the trends and the meme. You know, on the fun side, it's all the tropes and memes. But on the other side, it's like, well, if we really do care about this, we can critique this. And you start coming up with some of those things. And part of that was within 10 years, some of the things that you would say. And this whole new humans thing, it looks like it addresses two things. One, because he sets it up in his narrative talking, and Kirk, this is Kirk talking first person, you know, he's like, well, I know some people are into this whole new humans, of which Decker was supposed to be sympathetic,
mm-hmm.
which we get it when we get into the whole thing about jumping in the stream and melding with Delta, you know, with Ilea yeah. to form the new thing. That's kind of like, you know, setting up, foreshadowing that he's going to be open to, you know, the individuality versus the group. You read, Kirk describes that new humans thing as people who are willing to submerge their individuality to be a heightened human and be more part of a group, which is sounds like it's on the road to Borgdom, you know, which is kind of funny now. But they say that that became popular because of a Vulcan study that showed the early Starfleet crews were such perfect specimens that they were so pliant that then when they would encounter new life and, you know, super aliens and whatever, they could be seduced by that, or that they would get hung up and there were crew mutinies apparently earlier. So I don't know if he's looking back at some of the tropes from the episodes and seeing mutinies and deaths and some of the superhumans and people, you know, the Carolyn Palamises and the Madeline MacGyvers, you know, kind of thing, and trying to excuse away what 10 years of the style of the 60s into the style of 70s and people loving the show, but looking back at some of the right. excesses and going, just like you would put women in pantsuits and pants now and get them out of the miniskirts. Even though miniskirts were an act of rebellion in the 60s. I have to remind everybody of that.
That's true.
Yes. Yes.
That's really interesting because like that decade removed from the original series, I feel like during the run of the series, of course, Roddenberry is just a showrunner who's kind of in the weeds trying to get that next episode out. And then a decade later, it's no longer just a TV show. It's this whole thing. Like, it's Star Trek. And now it has to...
Yeah, this big philosophy.
Yeah, it's a philosophy. Exactly. And he wants to make that world real.
And Gene is not just a producer trying to sell pilots of projects. He's a guy trying to pay his mortgage. So he's talking on the college campuses. And now he's a guru.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
And that's where we are now. And he's, you know, believing his own... I mean, it's all good stuff. It makes a lot of people, you know, aspirational for the future. But... Yes, the tables had totally turned, and he's 10 years older, and he's already started, you know, they say Picard is Roddenberry as an older man, and Kirk is Gene as a younger, you know, the guy that rode motorcycles and experimented with drugs, and that's young Gene, and Picard is older Gene. Well, here's 10 years later Kirk mellowing a little bit in the middle of all that, too. So, mm-hmm. But yeah, he's... The new humans is kind of like a sop to both trying to explain away some of the rough edges of the drama tropes they used in the 60s and say this is a reaction away from that. And then it's also, though, in Kirk saying, but I'm not one of them, because that same 10 years of kind of reflection, people are going, wait a minute, why? It's 200 years in the future. Why is Scotty still talking with a brogue? Why is Chekhov still talking with a really bad Russian accent? Why, right. You know, all the cultural heritage, you know, you got hints of that when Uhura is so past it. She says, you know, Lincoln calls her a negress and she's like, it's okay. It's an old term. I don't care. You know, she's so beyond worrying about anything PC or not. And people would say, what is with the cultural clinging? And that's, to me, I think that's also what that answers. When Kirk says, well, we're kind of throwbacks, and eventually they studied things and figured out that we were actually healthier and stronger mentally for space travel than the new humans, you know, some of that movement were. So I think it's addressing two things that way. And again, it's all things that after 10 years of reflection, what people were starting to notice, you know, and the 60s giving way to the 70s and just culturally and sociologically. Can I say that? Looking at what, you know, they love the basic tenets of Star Trek, but the, you know, more things in the Christmas light consoles were starting to evolve in sensibility. You know,
things that we would today call problematic or, you know, something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's us. But there you go. It's all, it's the beginnings of retconning. You know, it's what I say, texture, not trivia. It's like, we're going to smooth this out with an explanation, not just, oh, I'm sorry, it's the 60s. Let's just ignore it and move on, you know, try to ignore it. But here he's, you know, there's so much goobery good stuff just for the fun's sake in the, what am I doing that? In the novel. But there, I think some of these, the Tahila is certainly like the biggest one. Mm-hmm. And then the, yeah, and people forget that whole, because it got dropped. And then you get into like, you know, Next Gen, and the DS9 era, and you have everything from like the new fundamentalists. I mean, you have you see movements, right? And on Bajor and on Cardassia, and you see that within other cultures. It's kind of, people like forget that, like, this was the original, aside from whatever the hell Severin and the space hippies were trying to do. but this is kind of like the first time somebody tried to give some, you know, it's not all just cookie cutter Starfleet guys and gals.
Yeah, and what interests me, because one of the things I wanted to also point out in chapter one, it starts off differently than the film, because Kirk is like in northern Africa on his vacation, and he has this sense sieve in his head because he gets a Starfleet emergency signal that's sent to this thing implanted in his brain. And this, plus some of the things we were just talking about, we've never seen used.
He's
on
in the
screen.
Admiralty. Yeah.
I'm kind of surprised if Gene Roddenberry came up with these ideas in this book. Why haven't we seen those used even in the Next Generation when he was overseeing?
Well, them? I think the ideas came up as he wrote the amazing thing. When you look at the novel, it's like, where does what you see on screen actually happen? It's like two or three chapters go by of the novel before you actually get to the scripted, you know, filmed bit. And so he's fleshing it out. There wasn't a 2-hour movie script. You need a little bit more to at least get a, you know, a 5/8 inch thick paperback. And so some of that's just fleshing out the movie like anybody would do when they novelize. But yeah, all this prologue stuff is where it's also good, because he can do 10 years of backstory for anybody who, if you care enough to see a movie that you want to see the novel, and they knew that fans would, of course, snap up the novel. He's getting, again, it's like one more last stop that he can cram stuff in. Now, why he wasn't carried on? Well, he got dethroned. He's not doing the movies, much less writing novelizations now. It's all out of his hands.
But when it gets to the Next Generation, you know, he was overseeing that show. I'm surprised he didn't work in, you know, references to New Humans or had the writer staff doing these things.
I don't know if somebody actually said, that's an interesting thing. If somebody actually said, I could just see him having like Richard or Susan or somebody like sit down and go through all the movie scripts and let's figure out what we like and don't like. Or I don't know if like he... this is a whole good topic. I don't know if something exists to get Gene's attitude about the whole motion picture experience as the years went by, because he was so focused on trying to keep his throne and keep his voice, even as he had to politically give way, you know, to Harv Bennett running the movies. And then when he was able to get that back and not have that cadre do the new series, when he was able to grab that back and kind of right some of the wrongs and get back some of the respect and the finances and the status, you know, with the Next Generation. He was kind of like, and even the 3-year cancellation for the original series, there was so much that got fixed with the Next Generation, I think, in his ego and status and, you know, well-being. That he's getting his, you know, haha world. See, I wasn't a fluke and I wasn't a fluke and I didn't, you know, I didn't just was a lucky guy that stumbled over the right rock and we picked up a treasure chest and I had nothing to do with any of this. It is me. It really was me. And now we're going to do it again. So he got a lot of that back with Next Generation. And I don't know. And I'd like to now go look and see if he talks in some interview somewhere about his feelings about the motion picture, if he tried to bury it. Because I don't think he went around going, you know, I was so wrongly accused. Everything that I got thrown at me, I was dumped on for the motion picture. And I mean, we're talking about the novel, but the whole ball of wax. Because the 80s just turned into him trying to survive and keep his head above water and, you know, stick up for what he believed in, which wasn't just with Harv. Sometimes it would be with Shatner and Nimoy, like who was running a movie and how they would work things out. And, you know, those memos are back and forth. But how he looked at the whole motion picture experience. So when they sit down to do Next Generation, you're talking about the transceivers. I don't know if they sat down and, like, wanted to go back and go, oh, let's put all this out. Because, like, no, like, those uniforms never got used again. You know, like, nobody even pulled them out to go, oh, look, here's a flashback scene. For, like, they did the maroons all the time, right? All through Next Generation. Oh, here's Jack Crusher's throwback holodeck, you know, or here's young Picard with hair getting stabbed. Any of those scenes, they would go back to the maroons. Well, in timeline, the maroons had obviously replaced the pajamas, and these could have been around for a lot longer because people forget, you know, the motion picture is 2 years, 2.5 years after Turnabout Intruder, or the animated series actually should be. But then it's like another 15, 16 years until Wrath of Khan. So those, a lot of things could have been in play in universe canon timeline for a long time. So it's not like in our perspective, oh, those were like horrible uniforms. They tried them and they ditched them in 2 years. That's what Paramount did.
Well, it's interesting too, because, you know, with new Star Trek, they're mining some things that, you know, from the old series and even some from the novels or notes or whatever, we may get references to some of these things in a future Discovery, Picard, whatever series. There may be a reference to the new humans on Earth. It might be just a line in a show. I mean, it would not surprise me if somebody digs in through these.
Well, now that the fine hand of Kirsten Beyer is showing itself more and more, not just that she's in there swinging, but that she's got clout now and is being listened to more and more. And Michael Chabon appears to be a willing, I can't wait to talk to them, because it's like I feel like I'm starting to see the beauty of someone saying, no, canon does not have to be an anchor around our necks. There are billions of things we can explore, which is what I've said. Right. And I go, you know, David and Dayton and all the Kirsten, all the novelists have been doing this for years, pulling bits of the old, new, adjacent, whatever, and pulling them into. Yes, it's ostensibly a Voyager novel or a Next Gen novel, but it's the universe, which is why I always think it's funny when somebody says, oh, that's, they see something and they go, oh, that's just fanboys. That's just fan service. And I go, no, it's not. Unless it's stupidly gratuitous, you know, like if they walk by and go, oh, look, when did you get that poster of a Tribble Anatomy? Oh, I just got it yesterday. Wow, that's fun. Okay, well, back to our story. I mean, that's fan service. But if you use the universe, you know, I mean, that's called using the universe. That's not fan service to me. So, yeah. But things like it's funny how he brings up the transceivers in the novel, but then he immediately talks about the mind control revolts because they got politicized. Yeah. You know, on the heels of the eugenics wars, enhancing humans. It's kind of like, eh. So, I don't know. I just, you know, and then it's all before World War III. So, it's funny. Someday, somebody's going to, if by the time we get around to doing the 21st century Star Trek shows, like, you know, pre-Archer and pre-World War III or whatever, it'll be like the Caprica of Star Trek or something. It'll probably die, and by the time we get there, we'll be like in those years anyway, so it'll all be a moot point. But
yeah, I want to see like a Short Trek episode about the mind control revolt. Like
what, the bloody mind control revolt.
The bloody. Now, yeah. Is it the bloody mind control revolt because it was, you know, a horrible bloody thing, or did just like a working class Brit name it? Oh, that was bloody mind control revolt.
That's so annoying. That's so annoying. I didn't ask for the bloody mind control votes. Yeah. No one expected the bloody mind control revolts. No, that's to me, that's like of all the EndNote canon that's wacky through the novelization, and we still barely like scratch this. The mind control revolts are like the what? It's like, do you really? So are we like gonna this whole thing about is it really canon? Even though it's in Gene's novel, are we gonna treat this like some Jerry Taylor stuff about B'Elanna or something and just kind of go, well, she wrote it, but everybody immediately ignored it and she lost her clout, so no one had to, you know, follow it. But yes, let's start a petition, Dan. We want the mind control revolt short trek.
Now, I don't know if I want my name on this, but okay.
Oh, okay.
I'll take my name on anything that's Star Trek.
Yeah, and more Star Trek, whatever. Yes, I'm on board. Never mind. I take back what I just said.
The other thing, we were talking about the whole thing with the patch, and supposedly they're going to honor the Enterprise being the first and only ship to come back. I love that phrase. The relatively intact after its 5-year mission. The other thing that I swear, and this is much not near as big a deal to people, but it is to me. I swear to God, somewhere in the middle of talking about McCoy spending his time out decoding the Fabrini technique, you know, throwback to Natira, and For the World is Hollow, that he's spending his time on Earth trying to bring the Fabrini medical knowledge into the mainstream. And the novel says that he goes into the new sick bay with Chapel. By the way, there's a great McCoy. You know, all those bits in the movie, you go, well, Gene did get them in. Like, there is a McCoy Chapel scene where they talk to each other. And like, you know, yeah. And he's like, oh, that whole thing about, oh, I bet she's a doctor now. You know, I don't know. They actually give him a moment. And she mm-hmm. says, well, basically, she got her doctorates finished, like, right after the 5-year mission. She's had it for 2 years, so she's not even green around the gills doctoring. But somewhere, the novel says he'd been off translating the Fabrini, and that he was pleased to see a lot of Fabrini technology and medical knowledge put into the biocomps, put into the Starfleet database. Somewhere, though, I swear to God, I read that somebody official had postulated that not he was doing that, but what he was doing for a day job, basically, and yes, I know money, blah, blah, blah. But what he was doing for a day job was he was so getting away from like humans. He wasn't quite hermiting, but he was like next door hermiting back home in Georgia, working as a veterinarian for like the farmers and the agricultural. Basically said he was kind of a recluse while he translated the Fabrini records, and on the side, just for a day job, he was acting as a veterinarian and treating people's animals, you know, just around him in local Georgia. He was in the back hills in Georgia being a veterinarian, treating animals, while he was translating the Fabrini records.
But you don't remember where you
saw that. And I have looked and looked. I did not dream that. I've said that for years, and the last 5 or 10 years, since people shove a microphone in my face now, and it's like recorded. And I'm going, you know, I want to. It's like, it's exactly like the patch. It's the Enterprise, Starfleet adopts the Enterprise patch thing. I'm like, I know I saw it. I cannot find where that is. And that's even more arcane and obscure than the Enterprise patch thing is. I know I did not dream that.
Weren't there like publications around this time of biographies of the characters or something? Or right before Star Trek II, I think there was something.
Well, they did a ton. Like, well, there was a paperback that a guy put together called Star. He interviewed people on one. It was the Star Trek interviews. And then he did one of character biographies that was horrible. It was like, it's like pocketbooks for the first 2 or 3 years when they would do nonfiction books. All this fan stuff had been like vetted and put out there, and the best of fans doing stuff on their own and working out timelines and, you know, figuring things out, and things being just after a while, after 5 or 10 years, being accepted. And it's almost like there was some, I haven't found a smoking gun memo, but it's almost like somebody, the spaceflight chronology is the same way to me. But it's like all these details are put in and they're like exactly opposite, or they're totally not using anything that basically all of fandom in paper and stamp days had kind of settled, or the echelon of fandom, the layer of fandom that cared about that weren't all the women writing zine magazines and doing Spock stories. Like the 10% of the world that was into background fandom had all kind of settled on this stuff. And some of it came from the fiction side. And it's like the official pocketbooks, the first ones, like rejected all this. And it was, unless it was on film. And it was just like, well, this is nice, but it's... And what's funny is over the years, like all that stuff has, the spaceflight chronology and the Star Trek II biographies. But it's like all that stuff has been like not rejected. It's like it's just been forgotten about and never used. And as time moved on, everybody, because the Iras and the Rons of the world, Ron Moores of the world, and the Rene Echeverrias of the world, were all fanboys too. And they all read the stuff that made sense and had been around forever. You know, like D7 for Klingon, the original Klingon battlecruiser, was never canon. It came out, totally came out of fans who were trying to make up an alphabet for the three characters you saw on the pylon of the original Klingon battlecruiser. And somebody turned that into something like D07 or something. And so D7 came from that original alphabet. But that was never official until Ron put it into the retconning in Trials and Tribulations on DS9.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's interesting how they went with some things and not others. Like you're saying, they just kind of forgot about things or just changed it.
It was kind of like fan sensibility. It's like, this is why this whole thing about canon nowadays is really interesting, and it's not black and white, and canon has evolved because Star Trek has evolved, and there are a lot of, you know, it's like USPA, United Earth Space Probe Agency, versus Starfleet. They were evolving the show. One of them eventually wound up. You've got two on film. You've got a United Earth Space Probe Agency, and you've got USPA said. And somewhere along the way, and then, you know, good old Jeff Bandel brings it back and sticks it on the side of Friendship One at the end of Voyager. So now you really can't run away from it. But it's like I say, texture, not trivia. It's like, rather than sit and go, oh, this is wrong, and this is right, they made a mistake. It's like, no, like, figure out, like, the real world is not perfectly made. There are exceptions to every rule. There's texture in the grain. You listen to an actor talk about if it's a comedy, try to find the dramatic moments. If it's a drama, try to find the comedic moments for texture. And it's like, take all that and come up with the wacky, why, you know, what was that about? There's something, somebody latched, you know, whatever. So a lot of that stuff. So that's that. But that's why I bring this back around, why it was so cool, the Klingon battlecruisers, to distinguish them not being the smooth-sided, cheapy little things from the series. Gene gives them this, you know, never is this uttered on screen, but every little tech nerd knows what a Katinga, you know, Klingon battlecruiser is. And it's only because Gene came up with that word and gave it to them in the novel. It's not in the movie. You know, nobody says, Captain, we're picking up three Klingon Takinga heavy battle cruisers on the, you know, Epsilon 9.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that's a very tiny little thing, but that totally comes from the novel.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I have discovered Dr. McCoy as a veterinarian.
Where?
It is apparently from the script for the God Thing. McCoy has left Starfleet to become a veterinarian.
Okay.
That is one reference that I found to it anyway.
And it stayed, well, and then either it just stayed in the ether in my brain, but I didn't see the script for the God Thing. I mean, like if it was a talking point that Dee said out loud somewhere or Gene said out loud somewhere, that or maybe too, somebody with access, you know, at conventions talking, and it was just in the ether by 74, 75, and it just floated. Or even when they were promoting and doing the motion picture, and it was just out there. And
it makes sense because Gene Roddenberry was working on a novelization of the God Thing as well that was never released. So it makes sense that he would have all of those notes and things that he would be working on and talking about.
I so want that novelization.
I know. Every time I see the like mock-up of the cover and stuff, I'm like, can someone finish this, please?
Jan Friedman had a contract to do it. The basic problem is that there was never a coherent God Thing finished script.
Right.
And we're going to get into this eventually on the Trek Files, but I got to figure out how to get our arms around all these 70s movie scripts. But that's why we haven't dived into them yet. And there's so many iterations of things and back and forth and notes, but the notes don't mean anything unless you can see what the drafts were and like, how do we do it? But basically, it was like the impossible. It's like some movie projects I know where they shoot and shoot and shoot and they even shoot a script, but then when they're wound up with is like, it's just, it doesn't hang together. It doesn't, you know, make a thing, doesn't flow. And so that's kind of why it was rejected. Or maybe you had a narrative draft, you know, prose draft, but then when you went to script form, it never got done because they pulled the plug on it. So you never finished it. So yeah, trying to make hash there, you know, and the thing kept changing and it was rejected for a reason. Maybe it was rejected because it was a horrible story or a wacky story. So trying to clean it up for a novel is problematic. Because, you know, if Gene could have, he would have.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and things are much more into, you know, self-publishing now. And, you know, in the 70s and the 80s, we were still in, you know, old school. Publishing houses had to print books and send them out in cartons to bookstores to get to you, kind of a thing. And now the digital revolution. But, and maybe you'd think about it being a little more fluid now, and that could happen. Maybe someday somebody will take another shot at it. But
oh, that would be great. That. I would love that so much.
We'd eat it up, of course.
Yeah. And speaking of print books, and you mentioned pocketbooks earlier, Star Trek The Motion Picture was the first novel published by pocketbooks. And here we are all these years later, and Simon Schuster is still printing Star Trek novels since 1979.
That's when, you know, that's when everything realigned, and everything, you know, like all the nonfiction books, Space Flight Chronology and the any of the, you know, the make your own costume book and the motion picture sticker book. I mean, they licensed it big time. It all flopped. You know, they had a lot of action figures and all the time. The first Happy Meals at McDonald's were licensed. They didn't have Happy Meals and then did a motion picture version. They launched McDonald's launched Happy Meals in the boxes for kids with the motion picture promotional.
I remember getting one of those when I was a kid.
Oh, man.
I remember sitting in the car and eating out of that box. That would have been, so 1979, because
like
this came out in December. I was, oh gosh, I wasn't even that young. I was 12. But still, you know, I mean, 12, I mean, Happy Meals kind of skew younger, but I think I did because it was new. It was cool, you know?
Yeah.
Like, oh, I want the box thing, you know? There's a toy inside, too. Come on.
I would have loved that.
This is cooler than Cracker Jack.
Kind of sad because 1979, I was -3.
That's okay. Well,
the food still tastes the same, Dan. So if you want to go to McDonald's,
no, I want the motion picture box.
I know.
I've seen the ads on YouTube with the Klingons, though.
There were like six varieties. There were like six different boxes, basically.
Oh wow!
I mean, the meal was the same, but there were like six different printed. You know, that had one of them had a little game on a thing with movers, and some of them just had puzzles around the box. And anyway, the back to the novel. The other cool thing that's in the novel that's not on screen is the belt buckles. I always knew they were called purse scans. I don't know what the rest of the world is so confused about. There is, it's like what I call canon in a vacuum. If somebody comes up with something that halfway is reliable and nobody has counted it on film, then that's what it is. And if the person doing it's Gene Roddenberry, what is the big deal?
Now, one of the things about those specifically in this novel that I found really interesting, and I didn't remember from reading it before, but really stuck out to me this time, was, of course, like you said, they're per scan devices. They transmit the medical data from each person to sickbay. And even the idea of like data privacy is brought up in the novel, which I had not caught on to before, because the last time I read this novel, that probably wasn't even really on anyone's mind anyway. Mm-hmm. But this novel, Gene Roddenberry had it way before anyone else here. You know, your personal data is being transmitted on some sort of network. There's no chance that anyone else will be able to intercept it because of all these triple redundancy things. And I was like, that's brilliant. Like, who thinks of that? That's great.
What's sad is between this and Wrath of Khan, though, that there were the bloody medical privacy data revolts.
Those bloody medical privacy data revolts.
But I thought that was interesting that he went down that road with the transceiver, the sensever.
Mm.
And yeah.
Well, then there's also Dan, I know that you want to talk about V'ger's perspective in this book, that we get more of that from a book that we can't get in a movie.
So there's an entire chapter that's all from V'ger's perspective, which, you know, was not something they were able to do in the film. And I find, you know, I've watched the motion picture a million times, so, you know, I understand it backwards and forwards. I love that movie. But you know, it could be a little confusing not knowing exactly what happened to V'ger, how it came to be what it is, and what its ultimate goal is without, you know, the characters kind of figure it out and say it. But in this novel, we get basically all of those questions are answered in this one chapter, because V'ger kind of recounts his journey and says what he's trying to find and what he expects to find. And it's just all laid out like that. And I thought that was a really interesting use of the novel format to just kind of, you know, oh, this is a little confusing. I'm just going to clear that all up for you. Here's V'ger to speak a little bit about what he's all about. And V'ger, go ahead.
it's like, okay, the one thing I'm going to address that's not like a 10-year simmering fan theory or fan debate or something is, point of view of the, which gets back to, you know, Gene, the whole thing about, you know, Hordas versus salt vampires. I mean, it's like it's not like us. What is anything we don't know how we call a thing? You know, that whole Star Trek respect for even lower life forms or whatever, much less intelligent life hidden is something that's not intelligent. And to do it from that's like the ultimate, right? V'ger's. I'd forgotten about that chapter. Now I'm like madly trying to find it. But the novel was the perfect place to speak up for that. And, you know, we'd never gotten to know so much for the motionless picture and the motion sickness and all of that, But take that, Nomad. You never got into the Nomad point of view because it was supposed to be a corrupted hybrid and was not on the cusp of sentience, whereas that was the whole point of V'ger, was that it was one step away from being launched out of the holodeck. Oh, wait. That's later.
Well, one striking element in this book is in that chapter, it said the resistance was futile, of course. There's that
just
sentence
teed
in there.
That right now, up for how, you, didn't we?
How odd is that? Like, do you think Gene Roddenberry remembered putting that line in this and took it to the writers later?
I don't.
I think it's just coincidence.
I think it's coincidence.
I think
just
so
like
too.
What a crazy coincidence! Because there are theories, and there was even novels that suggest that V'ger came from the Borg. Homeworld.
Right. Well, that was Gene talking around the office, and it really got memorialized by Mike and Denise sticking it in a footnote on the V'ger entry in the first encyclopedia.
Right.
It's like one of those floaty things when things are kind of vague. And that's where it really stuck in, I think, fandom's consciousness was, oh. Now, somewhere, we're going to do a Trek Files on this, my weekly podcast from Roddenberry Podcast Network. When we found a piece of paper that somebody has done a backstory for V'ger, but there's no dating, there's no name on it, there's no, and now I'm wondering if maybe it was done, whether it was done for the pilot or for the movie script or even for, you know, writing the novelization. But we were even like trying to look at the style of the typing on the page and like match it up with things from that era, if that's even possible, or who did it.
Wow.
But anyway, or if it's a Jesko von Puttkamer, you know, science NASA consultant thing, or if somebody in the office did it. But anyway, but that's the kind of thing that makes me wonder if maybe it was, he did it for the, had somebody put that together so he could use it, not for the script, but for the novel, you know?
Right. Mm-hmm. No, absolutely.
So stay tuned for that one, kids, coming soon.
I listen to that show all the time. It's
coming down the line.
Now, we've talked a little bit about this already as well with Decker and kind of his motivations being a little more fleshed out in the novel. We mentioned that he was kind of sympathetic to the new human movement, that type of thing. In the novel, I love that it gives a little bit more weight to Decker's final moments and why he makes the decision that he does. Not only does he have that new human kind of influence going on there, but at one point in the novel, they're pretty explicit about what happens between him and the Ilea probe. And based on what we know about what coupling with Delton does to a human brain, he's kind of messed up for the last, third of this novel. And, there's really nowhere for him to go but to join with Ilea and V'ger at the end because, like, they kind of make mention he's getting a little bit more disheveled as the rest of the novel goes on. Like, he's in pretty rough shape.
They didn't really get into that in the movie, much as you wanted the Enterprise, I want this. I think it's, like, a little more than he wanted the Enterprise, I want this.
Yeah,
but, yeah, the whole end scene there around the V'ger, the NASA, the Voyager 6 probe, when they reveal it. It literally is the last few pages of the novel. There's not, like, a lot.
Mm-hmm. It wraps up very quickly.
There's about three or four lines past what you got past out there that away.
Yeah.
And And it's really, it comes at the crash of the, at the apex of the novel. But there is more of the, there are, you know, as you, like I said, with the McCoy Chapel, there are some little scenes that elongate out just to flesh out the novel and take advantage of the format. But, and it's not all just, I mean, there's some subtext and inner monologue things explained from what you see on screen, but there's, there are some extra scenes, but there's not a ton of, there's not a ton
there
of
aren't,
them.
And then, and as you know, there's different cuts of the motion picture, right, and some scenes that weren't in the original theatrical release that were later added in the, even the TV release or the director's edition.
And Gene Roddenberry is subtle, but also not subtle, because I think there's even a line
there's
where
an infamous, yeah,
where Sulu. Well, there's another very unsubtle line about Kirk.
About Kirk,
a
yeah,
physiological reaction that he has. But I remember during that Sulu scene too, he said something like, Sulu was trying to hit the right button and wanted to stand up to reach it better, but realized that like he shouldn't do that. He shouldn't yeah, be standing up right yeah, now. And I'm like, oh, okay. And I think 10-year-old me didn't get that, but reading it now,
Zoom,
I'm like, oh, that's pretty apparent.
I don't, yes, I don't get it, Dan. Would you please explain that to me?
Well, I'll tell you when you're a little older there, Bruce.
Yeah, yeah. They did they put the, there was originally a scripted scene because David Gerald had it, or somebody, Susan Sackett had it in their column in Starlog, the scene where Kirk actually goes and talks to Nagura was like, oh, in the, maybe it was just an audition scene. I've gone, I want to go back and look through older scripts.
I do remember, but, that in the novel, I think.
Yeah, he goes up to the office.
Going into the office. And
oh,
then
actually, no, it's here. It's on page, oh, it 43. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I found it
this
too.
This must be rather yeah, difficult for you, said Nagura. Captain Decker has been something of your protege, hasn't he? Yes, sir, but oh, I don't see right, how that makes it difficult. Anyway, but one thing that is in the book that you don't get is he specifies, they don't say how many are on the rec deck scene. He goes out of his, the narrative voice, if it's Kirk, I guess, says, you know, like, we never did this before, had the whole crew. It's funny. It's like there are these TV, you know, in canon, out of canon, in universe narrative book form, whatever, mm-hmm, throwbacks back and forth. And one of them, he's saying, we've never had everyone on. There was no need. We would just get to, but this is a special case. And now we've got the space to do it in with this new three decks high rec deck. But they do, aside from that little nod, he does say after it's over that 31 of the crew, he gave them the option to stay or not, mm-hmm, which is just blasted through in the film.
Yeah.
But in the novel, he says 31 decided to leave.
Yes.
Of the 400 yeah, and something. So they don't say if the crew is bigger than 430 or not. They just yeah, leave that, you know.
But they were able to replace them with another 31 thrill seekers based on
yeah,
how you put it. It's like, oh, there's always people on Earth that really want to risk their lives. So we're cool.
Yeah. You know, it's so weird because we read so much stuff and you know, we start to get things jumbled up. And because I'm even thinking, I feel like this book described another part of the ship that we didn't see in the movie, but now I can't place that in my mind. But maybe I'm confusing that with something else I've read.
The one I remember was Spock going into like a meditation pod, and he was like, oh, there's some other pods that other people are using for other things, and darn my Vulcan hearing, I can hear them doing those things, and I really wish I couldn't, or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, this is upsetting my emotional
in those meditation
control
pods. Yeah, there's one. The other thing that's it's like we've been talking about some of the highlights. Some of them are like googie little trivia, and some of them are major points. But there's little places where it's almost like the necessities of getting the damn script done, and like, and all the horrendous rewrite, and you know, figuring out an ending on the run, and things that had to be like the memory wall being cut out and replaced with another sequence that an effects house did, you know, to get the narrative across.
Yeah,
and you get to the end of that.
Memory wall's not in here.
Yeah, memory wall was out in time.
Yeah.
But you there's a couple, every once in a while I'll be scanning through and find a little moment where it's the kind of thing that when you watch the movie the first time it's not a big deal, but after four or five times you may go, wait a minute, what? And there's one little moment here, and there's probably many more, where the moment where Kirk takes command back from Decker, which is the big shock. And then he says, and we also lost Sonak. You know, we lost the transporter casualties, the two casualties. I'm going to need a science officer. He says, I'd prefer a Vulcan. And Decker immediately says, well, there's none rated on this design, sir. There's no Vulcans rated on this design. And then they have Kirk thinking, how did he know that already? Like, does he just know that in his head on the run? How did he know I was going to ask for a Vulcan? And he would say, "There's a." But then Decker says, actually, there's nobody rated on this design except, like, me, who could act as a science officer. And then Kirk says, okay, da-da-da. But there was a little, it's like Gene takes the opportunity to, like, little things that don't make a big deal, but just the logic of the moment, something must have slapped him and gone, wait, oh?
Yeah, and you can, because when I watched that scene after reading this book, I thought about that very moment, what you're describing there.
Yeah, and it's funny, like, there would be a certain percentage of the audience that would, but I remember watching that movie, you know, a dozen times, and it never occurred, none available. In fact, there's nobody, right? You know, it never, but then reading that, like, Bruce, I was just like, oh, yeah, how does he know that?
Yeah. So, and then we've got a reference in here to the 2001.
Oh, yeah, right. The wacky little homage moment. Yeah, the wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Another one of those that, you know, when I was young, totally sailed over my head, but reading it this time, I think that might be 2001. And then, sure enough, I think it was Dayton Ward was talking about it on his Facebook with a bunch of people. And I was like, oh, that was 2001. Okay, cool.
Yeah. And Dayton's still in the green room right now. I think he's passed out. So.
Sorry.
We haven't woken him up yet.
Yeah. So here's one thing just researching today, just kind of refreshing my mind, I thought was funny. So Epsilon 9 at the beginning, right? Commander Branch and all of that. It's Epsilon 9. It's a station, right?
Yeah.
And I noticed that Memory Alpha is calling it calling it Epsilon IX, Roman numeral, which usually Roman numeral refers to a planet, meaning that now there's a star named Epsilon. This is the ninth planet around Epsilon. But everybody back in the day, it was a station, and stations got numbers, got Arabic numerals, not Roman numerals. And that's what, he didn't use a numeral, but he wrote out 9 in the novel, N-I-N-E. And everything, I was just going back and looking at people's interviews and visual effects guys' interviews, and everybody, the way the magazines were formatted from back in the day was Epsilon, you know, Arabic numeral 9, not Roman numeral 9, because of it's not a planet, it's a station. And I was like, just tonight, I was like, well, that's weird. And I'm going back and going back, and apparently, I guess, you know, what do I call this? The specificity of the Memory Alpha guys. Apparently, there was a joke graphic in Next Generation from Aquiel that had some reference to, you know, they were a relay station in Next Generation 100 years later, but and said something about, had some just throwaway Okudagram graphic that said something about comm traffic from Epsilon 9, and of course, whoever's, you know, getting it cranked out, Mike or whoever at the time, you know, sixth season Next Gen, puts Epsilon IX, not just, you know, just cranking it out. So from that being on screen, even though it's a tiny little goodogram, they've like made it Epsilon 9, even though it makes like no sense. And people all back in the day all had it as a, you know, not a Roman numeral because that implies a planet number. So anyway.
You gotta get that changed on Memory
Alpha. Gotta start it. Forget all your discovery hassles. We've gotta fix this motion picture thing. Anyway, I just saw that and I was like, you know, you go down the rabbit hole of the Arcana.
Yeah. Now Epsilon 9, they have different insignias on their uniforms.
Yes, Epsilon 9 had. Well, they hadn't gotten them. It's only been 2 years, and they're kind of out there on the frontier, so they hadn't got the.
They didn't get the memo.
They didn't get the replicate. They didn't get the Bob Justman memo that said it was okay.
That's right,
sir. Yes, Commander. We've uncovered this 20th century memo from a television producer that says we can keep our badges. All right, then.
We also found that document attached to something called an email.
not in 1968, but maybe in 2018. It's been delivered by something called a coolie and that's not a an Asian reference at all. I'm doing a I'm just having fun with my friend John Cooley. But it's this whole thing about I don't know where we are. In the novel there is an assistant engineer named Corton, who was named for the fan Janet Corton, who is the same Janet Corton that Q was named for in the pilot of Next Generation. Saw that, and then I went and then I went back and traced it back to it actually being confirmed. So they're pulling like goofy little fun things, And I know we mentioned it in passing, but I still want to go back to some of the sociology that Gene's doing. And it's not as overtly sexual as having the Deltons talk about immature sexual species and their pheromones attacking everybody. But the whole thing of, we mentioned Lori Siani, who's apparently supposed to be Siana, and I always thought it was Siani, which doesn't get mentioned in the movie. His admiral boss, who basically they set up that Nagura got him hooked up with into a marriage contract to keep him, to keep Kirk distracted enough to sit down and be an admiral and get over wanting to command, you know, have a center seat and be out on the frontier. Because he was too good a PR prize to let go, you know.
Right.
And mm-hmm. But the whole fact that Gene was postulating that, you know, evolved humans 200 years from now, we wouldn't worry about being, you know, this is Gene. The Gene with Eileen coming in the door, Majel in the office, and Nichelle out back at the office. This is the same Gene saying, well, you know, we're not going to be monogamous all our life. And one option is just to be married to somebody for a couple of years. And it's a contract, and you either renew it for a couple more years or you don't, and you go off and no one worries about it. It's just a contract. A contract is a contract, and we're all big people here, and we can either stay together and bond and keep renewing our contract, and or we go away at 2 years, and it's not like a loss. It's just the end of the run, and we all knew this might happen. You know, and it gets away from all the ugly things of, you know, emotions and anyway, that was kind of an interesting thing that no one ever talks about anymore. And I wanted to make sure.
No, but you know, that concept I remember being used in at least one, maybe two of the Lost Years novels that took place during, between the 5-year mission and
between this and, oh, okay. Are the Lost Years between that, or they're not between motion? Aren't there some novels between Motion Picture and Wrath of Khan?
Yeah, but the Lost Year novels are between where that was the original series and
And I'm actually currently reading those right now very slowly. Over the last 7 years I've read two of them. But yeah, Lori Siani plays a big role in those novels, and the marriage contracts thing, actually there's a bit where you know, their relationship is talked about, but also Lieutenant Riley has a wife contract that she ends up not renewing, and he's heartbroken about. So they've done some interesting things with it in the novels there as well.
So much for taking the emotion out of it then.
Yeah, no, it's very emotional in his case.
It would be so weird if like my contract with my wife was coming up at the end of the year. I'd be like freaking out right now, like, is she gonna renew? Ugh, that's weird.
No ice cream for her tonight.
Reference acknowledged.
Yeah. And the one last thing I'll say about this is, like, this is like the Picayune trivia stuff. I love how he gave the Vulcan High Master of the three priests, the three Vulcan masters, he gave her a name. So we don't have to just say the head Vulcan master and the two sidebar Vulcan masters. We at least have a name to sigh. And that they're at the plane of Gaul, which just laid there and then got picked up. You know, Enterprise picked it up. I think Gar and Judy used it in the Vulcan trilogy. And they got into it, Gaul being tied into the whole, the atomic war on Vulcan, you know, before the Romulans.
And then the Gambit two-parter, the psionic weapon was the Stone of Gaul.
That's what it was. Excuse me. Thank you, Dan. No, I was, yes, they did redo it, but it was the Stone of Gaul first. Back on that, which means it was probably, who did that? Renee, I think? I'm trying to remember who wrote that one, but yeah, Gambit. Otherwise known as the Star Trek Picard prequel series.
Apparently.
Gambit is a renegade merchant. Yeah.
Well, that being said, I think it's time we go into our final thoughts on this one. So, Larry, final thoughts about the novelization of the motion picture.
Well, final thoughts is, it's fun and wonderful seeing so many people give a fresh look, or maybe even a first serious look, to the motion picture. That's what anniversaries are good for. And people are doing sidebars. They're doing a new book on the art and effects, which is cool. The whole mystique of the latter day politics, or not politics, but the whole drama of trying to, you know, the original director's cut edition from, my God, 10 years ago, that David and Mike and Darren did with Robert Wise before he passed, to try to restore all those scenes that were cut in the mad dash to get the damn thing done that they had to abandon. but they didn't up-res it enough. And now there's a movement afoot to get it 4K'd and, you know, all of that. And any of that that gets out the motion picture and maybe gets it to, and purists will say, well, I want all the forms. I want what I saw in the, it's not quite on the Star Wars level, but it's like what I saw at the theater in 79 and then what I get now, that's cool. I just want it to be different. Like the original series remasters, Blu-rays and original, you know, as long as we have all the iterations. But the novel has got so much. Yes, all the novelizations of movies flesh out a 2-hour script and there's all kinds of things in there. And sometimes it's the novelist, and it's somebody who did them for years, you know, or whatever, gets into the good graces of licensing and gets to do it over pocket and gets to do it over and over, like Diane Duane for several times. They invent scenes because they think the logic needs it, and sometimes they're doing scenes that were cut from a script at sometimes the last minute, you know, and the only best record that until we get into the years of having scripts on file online is some of those scenes were, you know, saved because of they were late cuts that a novelist didn't know that and they got approved and printed with them in there. So either way, but the motion picture is, again, is not like any other Star Trek movie. And this novelization is not like any other novelization, you know, even the Jerry Taylor novelizations, but from Next Gen and onward in Voyager. But yeah, if you're thinking at all about it, think of the fandom, think of the 10 years, think of the dam breaking that supported the motion picture. And oh my gosh, just for a lesson in wacky 1979 Gene Roddenberry sociology, read the novelization. get all up on your mind control revolts, bloody as they are, and your marriage contracts and your Tahilaness and all of that. And the roots of Riker and Deanna are right there with, which we all knew anyway.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Yep. Yes.
Dan, what do you think?
Yeah, I have to echo a lot of what Larry said, of course. I've been probably unnecessarily harsh on novelizations in general in the past. You know, some of them are done well, some of them not so well. This one I remember reading early on because, you know, I was going to read all of the numbered Star Trek novels way back in the day. And this, you know, they made number one, so I had to read it. And I was really impressed with it back in the day. Not only does it flesh out stuff that we maybe needed a little bit more explanation in the film, but it's also, like Larry said, a peek inside the mind of Gene Roddenberry, the creator of all of this. And that peek is at times quirky and at times a little scary, but you know, it's always just really neat to kind of get a look inside the mind that created it all. So I definitely recommend this novelization. I enjoyed it as much this time as I did the at least two previous times that I've read it. It really does have a lot of really fun stuff. And, you know, if you like the motion picture like I did, or even if you don't really like the motion picture, I think this really adds to that experience and might make you turn around a little bit on your opinion if you don't enjoy that film. So highly recommend. Definitely read this one.
Yeah, I definitely feel that this novel is that insight into Gene Roddenberry, at least at this time. And I think any Star Trek fan that's like really deep into Star Trek lore and how the history of creating the series and the movies and such, I think this is definitely worth the read. And if you think that the motion picture goes a little too slow, well, the book goes through the cloud a little faster, so you know, you can enjoy it that way. So I'm going to go ahead and give it a rating. I'm going to say this is 5 out of 5 marriage contract renewals.
Definitely.
Do you guys want to give a rating like similar or?
Yeah, I mean, I would have to agree with that rating. I would probably give it 5 out of 5 repaired warp drive circuits thanks to the timely arrival of Mr. Spock.
Great.
Oh, I don't know what you guys are thinking, but I would give it 5 out of 5 of the cleanest mind control revolts you've ever seen. scale. Subceiver per scan or not. Yeah.
Well, Larry, I can't read your mind, but I think I know what you're going to say next. And that would be, where can people find you online and what other stuff are you got going on?
Oh, well, I'd signed these protocols against the sharing of my personal promotional data online, but I don't want to start a bloody revolt over it. So I'll just tell you. everything is basically at LarryNemechek.com. Larry Nemechek on Twitter, at Larry Nemechek, and Larry Nemechek's Trekland on Facebook. The same thing as Instagram. And on Facebook, every Tuesday, I have Trekland Tuesdays live with a topic and Q&A with whoever's listening at 1 p.m. Pacific on my Facebook page, on my Trekland main page. And then every Tuesday, as I think we sneaked in, the Trek Files comes out. We pull something out of Gene's files, a memo or a letter or to him, from him, fans, celebrities, other people in the production of the time, and a lot of non-Star Trek things, because it all reflects back on Gene, and it all reflects, even in the old days, a lot of things totally reflect on what's happening in today's world or in today's Trek. So, and that's been awesome, and I try to have a guest. I either have my co-guest is John Champion, but most of the time I try to have, who's the director-producer, but most of the time I try to have the likes of Dorothy Fontana and Doug Drexler and Rick Sternbach and Renee Echevarria and Andy Probert and Fred Bronson and people who had a hand somewhere along the way. And Bijo and John Trimble, people who had a hand in some of the subjects we get into with the files. So it's been really, that's been a lot of fun too. So those are both on Tuesday. You wake up Tuesday morning and the Trek Files is there on the Facebook page or whatever your podcasting device is. And
it's on our master feed here on Trek FM.
Yes, it is. Too. Thank you for the poke. Yes, it is on the master feed there. And otherwise, Portal 47 is our monthly mini-con all year long with a lot of live events. If you want to jump in the portal, if you enjoy deep diving, and I think anybody listening to any podcast, by the time you've got to this point in your Trekdom, you're wanting to take a deeper dive. And I invite everybody to come over to portal47.net. And our big annual open house, anniversary open house, my fourth anniversary, is coming up October 22nd, Tuesday night at 7 Pacific. We're about to announce the guest, but you can come on over to LarryNemechek.com/openhouse. And it's all free. It's a virtual ticket. And you can pre-submit questions, but I'll have an awesome guest. The prior guests have been Mike Westmore, Renee Echevarria, David Livingston, and Robert Butler, the director of The Cage. That was my first anniversary guest.
Wow.
So it's the one time of year we open the doors and show everybody how the live events at the portal, there's a lot more than that, but how the telebriefings work. So I invite everybody to come over right now and sign up. It's free, and I just need a head count. It's good to have a head count. So that's all happening. And then the next Trekland Treks happens all year long. If you're in LA and you want to take a get out of virtual world and come take a real life away mission, to some of the location film, you pick the location sites you want to go to. And on November 9th and or 10th, I do this four times a year. It's like a Trekland Treks in a plan and a package. It's a little cheaper. It's called LA Away Days. And you can go to LarryNemechek.com/awaydays and find all out about that, the 9th and or 10th. Otherwise, if you're just coming to LA sometime on vacation or business, check out TreklandTreks.com. Get in touch with me and we'll work you out for four sites a day and lunch. And bring your uniform, or bring your props, or bring your whatever you want to do a picture with, if that's your thing. And we will have an awesome time. But yeah, so that's everything Trekland going, guys. Thank you for asking me. And this has been fun tonight to dive back. Speaking of deep diving back into the novel.
Yes. No, I've been looking forward to this for quite a while.
Yeah,
so.
Me too, definitely.
Very exciting. Yeah,
it's always fun to pick your brain about Star Trek and the minutiae. So this was a ton of fun.
Picked brains stay fresh, so that's good.
Wow, you know, having Larry Nemechek, Dr. Trek, on the show can always guarantee that there's going to be a lot to talk about. And you know, the trivia, the minutiae that man carries around in his head. I just love picking his brain, like I said, about Star Trek and all this stuff. So that was so much fun.
I can just like listen to him like all day. I just throw something out and just let him go. You know, it's crazy. But the funny thing is that there's times I'm around him in person and I don't really ask him anything or talk Star Trek much. We're usually talking about food or something. You know, but it's like, but when he's like on podcasts and stuff, it's like I could just hear him all day because he's got so many facts and so many all this information in his head. It's just incredible. But it's been fun talking about Larry's brain today. But this isn't the only thing we've been discussing on the network. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Earl Grey. Okay, that's excellent. And it'll be interesting to see how we interpreted the topic, because I know I may have interpreted it maybe a little differently than others did. We'll see.
Is this another time travel thing?
No, I was going to say, no time travel for me, as long as Jellicoe doesn't come into this.
Sure, okay, we'll make that deal then. Awesome. I'm in.
All right. Literary treks.
And, you know, the stakes are really big. You know, we'll get there, but, you know, this Borg ship threatens Earth and all this kind of stuff, and it just feels like it's a lot of really comic booky, over-the-top stuff that doesn't quite fit right with the novel that came before it and the novel that came after it, if that makes sense.
Primitive Culture, a look at history and culture through Star Trek.
And Next Gen arriving was this sort of, wow, this looks incredible. I know when we look at sort of first season Next Gen now, what we're going is, wow, this is really slow and stagey. But in fact, it was incredible. It was absolutely game-changing.
The Edge, a Star Trek Discovery podcast.
Only because I was watching little bits of Emissary recently, is that he would see himself wearing that awful purple swimsuit and think, oh God, I can't wear that.
Oh my gosh.
Every time I see it, I'm like, whoa, I'm really glad I'm not wearing 24th century clothing.
If you wanted me to murder an entire society, fine. But I'm not wearing that bathing suit.
Too revealing.
That's where I draw the line.
That's funny.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. And you'll find us wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, Larry's Brain was my favorite episode of the original Star Trek series.
Yeah, but it really isn't all that good.
Well, if you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button for this podcast in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes of Literary Treks as soon as they're published. And please, if you have the time, leave us a star rating and written review. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. If you're not an Apple user, though, we've got you covered as well. You can find all of the Trek FM shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, YouTube, in most third-party apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well.
If you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, you can do that by becoming a patron on the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
We'd also love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place, of course, is the Babel Conference. That's our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel into the search field on Facebook and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and select Literary Treks, and that'll come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM.
And find us on our Goodreads group. We have bookshelves showing what we previously read, what we're going to read, and what we're currently reading, and all kinds of discussions are happening there. So just search for Literary Treks on Goodreads and click Join Group. And we'd like to thank Norman C. Lau, Ken Tripp, Greg Rosier, Brandon Shamatala, Justin Ozer, and Jeffrey Harlan for their support of the Trek FM network and being associate producers for Literary Treks as well. So, Dan, when you have a Senseiver in your head and I'm calling you to say, hey, it's time to record Literary Treks, what are you doing the rest of the time?
You know, I don't know about this thing. It's a little weird. It doesn't just give me a direct message. It just gives me this impression. It's kind of weird, but I prefer direct methods of communication, like on Twitter, where I'm at Kertrats, that's KERTRATS. I've also got a YouTube channel, youtube.com/Kertrats Productions. And of course, facebook.com/Kertrats Productions and treklit.com, where I review Star Trek novels, and the Babel Conference, of course. Now, Bruce, when you're not remaining seated at your navigation console because a certain Delton navigator has walked in on you, where can we find you?
I'm not telling. Wow. If you really want to know, you can tweet me at @Admiral_Rex and maybe I'll tell you. Or you can listen to Live from the Edge with me and Brandy Jackala. And we have one coming up on Short Treks, Ask Not. That's November 14th at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. And you can find me doing the Star Wars Report, talking about Star Wars. And, of course, you can find me in the Babel Conference. So thank you, everyone, for listening. And until next time,
live long
and read on.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number one.